I'm Veronica Dudo. Tonight on EWTN News Nightly, President Trump rolls back environmental regulations, possible effects we could see, and a Catholic response. The House passes a bill requiring identification in order to vote, and your driver's license may not be enough. We break it down. Plus, a Lenten pilgrimage, how Pope Leo is going beyond the Vatican walls to connect deeper with his flock. These stories and more tonight.
From EWTN, the Global Catholic Network, this is EWTN News Nightly.
Thank you for being with us on the feast day of Saints Saturninus and Companions, Martyrs of Abitina in Africa. Our top story tonight, the Trump administration describes it as the largest deregulatory action in American history. The Environmental Protection Agency is doing away with the endangerment finding. It's an Obama-era policy that determined carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases endanger public health. But the move is creating strong pushback and criticism, with legal challenges certain. White House correspondent Owen Jensen reports.
Veronica, good evening to you. President Donald Trump says his administration's deregulatory action will eliminate over $1.3 trillion of regulatory costs, and he's zeroed in on car prices.
Today in the Roosevelt Room of the White House, President Donald Trump says his administration is officially terminating
the so-called endangerment finding, a disastrous Obama-era policy that severely damaged the American auto industry and massively drove up prices for American consumers.
The president says auto consumers will save thousands of dollars.
This action will save American consumers trillions of dollars and will lower the average cost of a new vehicle by close to $3,000.
The endangerment finding is the legal underpinning of nearly all climate regulations under the Clean Air Act for vehicles and power plants, and is used to justify regulations such as auto emission standards. The National Resources Defense Council blasts the EPA, writing, "Instead of doing its job to keep people safe, the agency is systematically dismantling protections for the environment." And it says getting rid of the endangerment finding would reverse the single largest action to cut climate pollution in U.S. history. Senator Chuck Schumer calls it a radical move that flies in the face of basic science.
Let's be very clear what this announcement represents. It is a corrupt giveaway to big oil, plain and simple.
Lee Zeldin, the EPA administrator, has criticized his predecessors in Democratic administrations, saying they were willing to bankrupt the country in an effort to combat climate change. Zeldin says with the move today, taxpayers will save, and
what that means is lower prices, more choices, and an end of heavy-handed climate policies.
And Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins discussing the policy change and its impact on farmers.
This removal of the endangerment finding is just going to be huge regarding, you know, what they're required to have in their tractors, the emissions, et cetera. It's now going to take a huge burden off. So we're very grateful for that.
The president, under pressure to help bring down costs for Americans, telling reporters,
"We've basically stopped all windmills in this country. It's the most expensive energy you can get."
President Trump also said, in addition to car prices tumbling down dramatically, his words, he said cars will start easier and work better. And he also said fossil fuels have saved millions of lives. At the White House, Owen Jensen, EWTN News Nightly.
Joining us now is Aaron Lothis, Catholic theologian and expert in Catholic social teaching. Aaron, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So first, can you tell us a bit more about the endangerment finding?
Sure. The endangerment finding is a ruling that was established in a 2007 Supreme Court ruling, and it recognizes that greenhouse gases, such as carbon dioxide and methane, are pollutants when they harm human health and future generations. So for more than 15 years, the endangerment finding has provided scientific and legal foundations for limiting pollution from vehicles, power plants, and industry. So it's a legal statement that these greenhouse gases harm people's health, harm our ecosystems, affect our farms, our fisheries, and create problems that violate the human dignity of all, and and the right to healthy lives.
Now, in his encyclical on the environment, Laudato Si, Pope Francis emphasizes the relationship between the environment and mankind, and he builds on the teachings of previous popes. How are Catholics encouraged to view the environment and ecology?
That is such an important question, and what we see is that the environment is inseparable from people, from all the families of life. We live in this beautiful earth that is God's gift to us. God is our creator. We did not create the earth. We received it as a gift to steward, to care for, and to ensure that its gifts, its food, water, everything that grows is meant for the well-being of everyone. And so this is a responsibility that all Christians, all Catholics, and every person living on the planet has to care for our common home so that all can flourish. And what we're seeing under the climate crisis, what many people call global weirding, it doesn't always look like warming in some places. It looks like the weird patterns of storms and weather we're seeing. These crises hit the poor first and worst. The poor suffer the most from these impacts. And we are reminded that the early Christian communities cared for each other and prioritized meeting the needs of all. And so that is our call as Christians to act in the global church, to take care of all of the families of the world in a sense of unity, caring for the poorest, the most impacted. And the endangerment finding was a way of recognizing the cause of this harm. So it's a very serious concern to remove this protection that protects the dignity of life and recognizes our responsibility to act as stewards, taking care of God's creation.
Aaron Lothis, thank you.
Thank you.
A months-long immigration enforcement crackdown in Minneapolis is coming to an end. White House border czar Tom Homan made an announcement in a press conference earlier today.
I have proposed, and President Trump has concurred, that this surge operation conclude. A significant drawdown has already been underway this week and will continue through the next week.
Homan says public safety threats were removed following the arrests of undocumented migrants with criminal records. Federal authorities say the sweeps focused on the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area have led to the arrest of more than 4,000 people. House Republicans have passed a bill backed by President Trump that would impose strict voter identification requirements. Republicans insist it's needed to prevent non-U.S. citizens from voting in elections. Democrats argue it would restrict access and discourage people from going to the ballot box. With more on that and what it might mean for voters, let's check in with Capitol Hill correspondent Eric Rosales. Eric.
Good evening, Veronica. When you go to your polling station in the November midterm elections, you may have to arm yourself with more than just your driver's license to vote. That's because a bill called the Save America Act is now going to require a government-approved ID to cast your ballot. Republicans say that they want to crack down on states and jurisdictions that don't enforce federal voting laws.
There's only one logical reason the Democrats are opposing this. They want people to participate in the elections who are not supposed to. That's what the wide open border was about.
The SAVE Act provisions require proof of citizenship when registering to vote. Acceptable documents include a U.S. passport, certified birth certificate, or naturalization certificate. The bill also mandates that all voters present a physical photo ID at the polls and requires states to establish programs to identify and remove non-citizens from current voter rolls. This means your driver's license or even a federal real ID won't work and only about half of the population have valid passports.
So many people don't have the documents. What is the solution for passports? What's the solution to prove your citizenship? They're putting all of these really tough regulations on people to not be able to prove that.
Democrats accuse the Trump administration and Republicans of trying to suppress voter turnout.
It's to essentially suppress the vote. Seniors vote by mail. Army, servicemen around the world vote by mail.
Republicans claim Democrats have won elections through ballot harvesting, and this will stop that.
The Democrats cheat. They stole the 2020 election. They want illegals to vote. They're thinking, my God, we start requiring IDs and proof of citizenship, we'll never win another election.
Look, you need ID for everything, right? You need an ID to get a credit card. You need an ID, you know, everywhere. Everybody's asking for an ID. I mean, and so this whole thing that somehow people don't have ID, that is just a red herring.
The next stop for the bill is the U.S. Senate. Majority Leader John Thune has signed on as a co-sponsor and says that he wants to bring it to the floor for a vote in the coming weeks. But it may die in the Senate graveyard because 60 votes will be needed to pass it, which will require some Democrats to jump on board. At the Capitol, Eric Rosales, EWTN News Nightly.
Joining us now is Mike Morley, professor of law and the director at the FSU Election Law Center. Mike, thanks so much for coming on today. Now, currently, non-citizen voting in federal elections is already illegal. What are the current laws that mandate secure elections in the United States today?
So the federal law lays out a baseline of requirements with regard to voter registration, in particular the Motor Voter Bill, also called the National Voter Registration Act, which was passed back in 1993, guarantees citizens a range of ways in which they're able to register to vote for federal elections when they engage in transactions at the motor vehicle office, getting a driver's license or updating their address. There's also a postcard application that every state in the country is required to accept. In the course of registering to vote through any of these methods or through a state-created voter registration form, people are required to attest to their citizenship, right? Certify under oath that they're U.S. citizens. The Help America Vote Act that was passed in the wake of Bush v. Gore in 2003 then requires states on the back end to perform certain cross-checks of the information that voters provide to election officials. And for people who register to vote via mail, they're required to provide a form of identification before actually casting a vote for the first time. And the federal law lists the various types of identification that count as valid.
Democrats have attacked the SAVE Act as voter suppression, while Republicans argue that it's necessary after the influx of millions of illegal immigrants who came to the U.S. during the 4 years of the Biden administration. From a legal standpoint, what additional mechanisms would the SAVE Act create beyond current laws?
So the main change that the SAVE Act would enact is requiring a person to provide proof of U.S. citizenship when registering to vote for a federal election, and for people who are already registered to vote, when they update their voter registration records or like they change political parties, they change addresses at that point, then they would be required to provide proof of U.S. citizenship. And the statute identifies various types of documents that would qualify. And then if you don't have any of those documents, the statute then creates a process that allows you to prove your citizenship through other means to election officials. And the election officials then decide, based on that other evidence, whether you have satisfactorily established your citizenship.
Now, of course, this heads to the Senate, where it faces a tougher road. But if enacted, could this be vulnerable to any legal challenges?
Yeah, I think a legal challenge is almost certain, really, any time when you see states amend their election laws. We tend to see changes at the federal level much more rarely. But yes, legal challenges to new election requirements, particularly new security type measures, are extremely common. So I think a challenge would be filed almost immediately.
Well, we'll certainly be watching. Mike Morley, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Russia says it has blocked instant messaging app WhatsApp in the country, instead directing its citizens to use a state-backed Max app. Critics describe Max as a surveillance tool. The Kremlin says Meta can restore access to WhatsApp if it follows Russian law. So far, Russia has blocked other major platforms like Facebook since the invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Regulators are also targeting Telegram, which continues to operate as of now. While people try to use virtual private networks, Russia blocks many of the apps. First Lady Melania Trump reports more progress in her push for Russia to reunify Ukrainian children with their families. This comes just 8 days after we asked her for an update.
Has President Putin agreed to release any more Ukrainian children?
I'm working on it, and we are in the process, so I hope we have success very soon. I will keep you posted.
The First Lady says today marks the third time she has helped facilitate the return of displaced Russian and Ukrainian children to their families. She urges both countries to intensify their efforts to ensure the safe return of every child. And she says, quote, I have no doubt more progress will come. We have a lot more still to come on EWTN News Nightly. More backlash as controversy swirls over an appointment at the University of Notre Dame. We talked to a pro-life advocate about the move. And Pope Leo XIV is making his own Lenten pilgrimage, how he plans to connect with his flock. Welcome back. Responses continue to pour in over the controversial appointment made by the University of Notre Dame of a pro-abortion advocate to their academic staff. Susan Osterman was appointed as the director of the Lew Institute for Asia and Asian Studies and has publicly advocated for abortion rights. Bishop Kevin Rhodes of Fort Wayne, South Bend, Indiana, released a statement opposing the appointment and urging the university to rectify the situation. Joining us now is David B. Wright, founder of 40 Days for Life and executive director of the Life Leadership Conference. David, thank you so much for joining us.
It's an honor to be here with you.
So the response to Bishop Rhodes' statement was both swift and robust. You also weighed in yourself on X. Can you share with us your reaction?
Well, first of all, I was so thankful that Bishop Rhodes was such a courageous leader to be able to speak out, and he has a responsibility as the local ordinary of the Fort Wayne and South Bend Diocese, and for him to say that this is unacceptable and is a differentiation from Notre Dame's position as a stated pro-life institution and a Catholic institution, and to appoint Professor Osterman into this leadership role pending this upcoming July 1st date, it just cannot work. It cannot happen. So what was really encouraging to me was not only Bishop Rhodes' leadership, but then to see Bishop Robert Barron and Archbishop Aquila and Bishop Olson and others weighing in, as well as voices of students and pro-life leaders and so many others. And what I think it's important to realize is this is about, does Notre Dame want to maintain its Catholic identity and its stated pro-life stance? Because Professor Osterman has taken very decisive positions that counter to that, and for her to be nominated to this position is really antithetical to that Catholic identity. Professor Osterman has stated that the pro-life movement is founded in racism, and yet she fails to mention that the abortion industry's largest provider, Planned Parenthood, was founded by Margaret Sanger, who in her own autobiographical writings bragged about speaking at a KKK rally, and she wanted to get rid of the unfit and the feeble, and she was a racist eugenicist. And she also said, Professor Osterman said, that abortion was consistent with Catholic teaching in international development, and that is, of course, not the case. So I and so many others are thankful of Bishop Rhodes' leadership. That's what Episcopal leadership should be. And we're thankful for others who are weighing in with their voices. And it's very important for Notre Dame to now weigh this and say, there is still time, as Bishop Rhodes said in his statement. They have until July 1st before this appointment becomes official. They could still make a change, and they could decide we are going to have leadership of a Catholic university publicly reflect Catholic teaching so as not to create scandal.
Now, David, Notre Dame, a Catholic institution, as you just mentioned, a lot of people needed to sign off on this decision. Are you surprised that it made it to this actual moment?
I think it's important for all of us as faithful Catholics to recognize Notre Dame's prominent role as the preeminent Catholic, at least seen as Catholic, institution in the United States, and for us to weigh in and ask them, please maintain your Catholic identity and your stated pro-life stance. So even if different people, however it got to this point, it's not too late. And for all of us to raise our voices and to be able to say in a charitable way, we are Catholic, Notre Dame is Catholic, maintain that Catholic identity, do not create scandal by appointing leadership that is antithetical to Catholic teaching, and it's still not too late for them to turn the course and make a better decision. And I'm so thankful that the local ordinary and other bishops, and even in alignment with Pope Leo's teachings, I really think Notre Dame still has the opportunity to course correct, and we all hope they do that.
David B. Wright, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Up next on EWTN News Nightly, Making Waves, Vatican Radio celebrates a milestone birthday, how they are celebrating. Plus, the Pope is making special visits throughout Rome. Coming up, we'll tell you where he's going. Vatican Radio turns 95 today and celebrates decades of its transmission of the gospel, the voice of the Pope, and the papal magisterium. Vatican Radio began in 1931 under Pope Pius XI and has served nine popes since then. During World War II, Vatican Radio reunited thousands of missing persons and followed the events of the Second Vatican Council. Its anniversary coincides with World Radio Day, begun by UNESCO in 2012. Starting this Sunday and throughout Lent, the Pope will visit several parishes in Rome. The first will be on Sunday afternoon in Ostia, located on the coast of Rome. EWTN News Vatican correspondent Valentina Di Donato has more.
This Lent, Pope Leo XIV is stepping beyond the Vatican walls, visiting five churches in the outskirts of Rome to be close to his flock as the Bishop of the Eternal City. The Holy Father's first visit will be this Sunday to the parish of St. Mary, Queen of Peace, located in Ostia. The area faces a number of challenges, including struggles with drugs, but it's still able to persist due to spiritual resilience, a resilience which has grown with the news of Pope Leo's upcoming visit.
We are the first. So there is a great excitement and a great attention from all of us. The community of Ostia is really so excited, not just our parish, but all of Ostia.
Ostia holds significance for the Augustinian order. It is where St. Augustine experienced a profound spiritual ecstasy with his mother, St. Monica, shortly before her death there. It holds a great connection for Pope Leo.
They do extraordinary big things.
EWTN News Nightly went to the parish and spoke to Assistant Pastor Father Thomas, shedding light on why Pope Leo chose this seaside parish.
This church, when they began it, it was with the Augustinian fathers, the order of Pope Leo. And they laid the foundation, but they couldn't finish. So the Pope asked the Palatines to take it, and our general at that time sent the Irish Palatines all over America to take up collections to finish the church. So there's also an American connection here.
The Basilica has the images of Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King, and Gandhi, all winners of the Nobel Peace Prize, representing an ecumenical message towards the mission of peace. And hearkening back to Pope Leo's first appearance on the balcony shortly after he was elected Pope.
Peace be with you all.
EWTN News sat down with Father Giulio Albanese, Director of Communications of the Vicariate of Rome, which manages the diocese on behalf of the Pope, to better understand why these five parishes were chosen.
The connection is that in all these parishes, there are social challenges. And the Church, from this point of view, has decided to look after them. And this is a very important commitment towards the needy ones. The immigrants, people, young people affected by drugs. Well, the Christian community is there to help them, to share with them the love of God.
After Holy Mary, Queen of Peace in Ostia, the Holy Father will go to the Most Sacred Heart of Jesus in Castro Pretorio, the Ascension of Our Lord in the East, Our Lady of the Presentation in the West, and Most Sacred Heart of Jesus in Ponte Mammolo. Costantino is a Catholic who has been struggling in the streets here in Ostia. He goes to the church daily and is helped by Caritas, and he says how his faith is essential.
The more I go ahead, the more I have become illuminated. But you must have faith. You can't lose it. And you must have faith even in difficult moments. As I am passing through, as others may be passing now too, but faith gives you strength.
In Rome, Valentina Di Donato for EWTN News Nightly.
We thank you for watching tonight. Remember, you can follow us on social media, Facebook, X, YouTube, and Instagram at EWTN News Nightly. I'm Veronica Dudo. Good night and God bless.